And now we will talk about creation. I mean, how many times have we asked ourselves, what is life? How do we get here? What's it all mean? In a moment, Adam Rutherford joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Adam Rutherford with us. Adam, of course, is a geneticist. He has been working as a radio and television presenter, writer for the past few years, specializing, of course, in genetics, biology, evolution, science fiction, cinema, religion. He has written and presented several series for the BBC network on genetic engineering, evolution, anatomy, and art. And he presents his weekly flagship science show on the BBC radio called Inside Science, author of Creation, How Science is Reinventing Life Itself. And Adam, it sure is. Welcome to the show.
Hi, George. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Good. Tell me a little bit of how you made that transformation as a geneticist into a broadcaster, into what you do now?
Well, I guess I did a PhD back in the day about 10 years ago in genetics. I was working at a children's hospital here in London, and I figured that I was better at talking about science than I was at actually doing it. And it's highly competitive in labs, and there's always someone who works longer hours and is probably just a bit brighter than you. So I figured I'd do the thing that I was best at, which was translating it, talking about complex science and telling other people about it. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 10 years. I started writing for newspapers, and then I started doing radio, and then, you know, it just sort of snowballs, and then you find yourself talking to you 10 years later.
Good for you. You know, we've all asked ourselves the question you've asked, and that is, you know, what's life all about? What are we doing here? How did we get here? Does science answer that for us, or is it all faith-based? What is it?
Well, I think historically it has been faith-based, and that's because it is such a hard question to ask. I can't do the metaphysics or the philosophy. You'll have to leave that to philosophers and religious leaders. But what we have done in the last few years is make enormous strides of progress in answering the fundamental mechanics of what life is, what it does, and more importantly, for this conversation, where it came from in the first place. And that's all been a result of stuff that's happened within molecular biology and genetics, and us being able to track back through around about 4 billion years worth of evolution and get to the point where we've seriously got a model for how the first life actually began on Earth. And that's been, you know, one of the preoccupations of humankind since we've been thinking.
I am amazed, Adam, how every religion has so many similarities in terms of creation, what God might be. I mean, it is kind of uncanny, isn't it?
Actually, what I found in researching this book, so I'm very interested in religion, even though I'm not a person of faith, but in addressing evolution, you often are faced with arguments that are faith-based. And when I was researching the book, I became slightly obsessed with the various and incredible variety of creation myths that exist in all sorts of religions, and some of them are so outlandish that they're highly entertaining, and that's not to mock them, they're just very entertaining. So, you know, the one that most people, at least in the West and in my country and yours, know is Genesis, the Bible, mm-hmm. Adam and Eve and all that sort of stuff, 6 days of creation and God rests on the seventh. And that's a good story, it's a good allegory. When I started looking at the Hebrew Bible, which predates the Bible that we're most familiar with, actually it's not quite the same. So there's no apple in the Garden of Eden. Eve is not impregnated by Adam, but by God himself. And so there's lots of variance even within the monotheistic religion. Mm-hmm. But all these stories are incredibly conservative compared to some of the other more, well, dare I say it, fun creation myths. There's an Egyptian one, which I'm not sure I can, it's too rude really to mention on a family show.
Yeah. Protect the radio. By all means.
Exactly. The Finnish one is very good as well. It involves the sea god laying a giant egg, seagull's egg, on the knee of a seated maiden, which then stays there for 10,000 years until it becomes too hot, and then the egg falls off and cracks, and that forms the earth and the sky. Huh. And it sort of goes on like that, and they're they're wonderful stories, no more or less compelling than the ones that we're very familiar with, but, you know, great fun to think about. And unfortunately, as far as science is concerned, all wrong.
When we look at the beginning, when we talk about the Big Bang Theory, and, you know, you're a geneticist, but I'm going to tap you into physics for a moment and astronomy. I still have, Adam, one incredibly baffling moment to try to figure out what they're talking about. I mean, what would explode to create so much mass that we call in our universe? I just don't get it.
No, and I think I think it's perfectly reasonable not to get it, George. So you should not feel in any way ashamed. I am a biologist. I know some physics and some astrophysics, but one of the things that people struggle with in physics, at least in understanding physics, is that so much of it comes from maths, right? So much of the way we describe how the universe works, certainly at a quantum level and certainly at a deep astrophysical level, is derived from the fact that the math says it has to be like this, because many of these things are unobservable, right? So there are many observations which support the notion of the Big Bang, but, you know, that's pretty standard science now, mm-hmm. although it was very controversial for much of its existence in the 20th century. But much of the real details of physics is derived from the fact that the math says it has to be like that. And so we then have to build a picture on top of what the math says. And so mere mortals such as me and you really struggle with understanding these very complex and counterintuitive pictures, because, you know, the language of math that they're talking about is totally baffling, bewildering. So I have enormous amounts of sympathy and empathy for your position. And you know, often I have to argue with physicists, and they don't really talk the same language as us.
I mean, does science try to explain it to a point where...
Yeah, it is science, and I've got no reason to doubt that it's not true that Big Bang Theory is our best model for the description of the universe. I mean, we see it. We see the evidence for the Big Bang in the night sky, right? We see the movement of galaxies and the movement of stars.
That's what they say, I guess, yeah.
You know, the redshift is one particular measure that we've known about for a few decades, which is a similar effect to when an ambulance passes you and the siren changes tone as it goes past, right? So as the sound waves are coming towards you, they're slightly being condensed, and as they're moving away from you, they're slightly being expanded. So when that siren goes from being, you know, high-pitched into being slightly lower-pitched as it goes past your ears, that's an indication that there's movement, that the ambulance is moving past you. Now, we see exactly that in galaxies. We see not in sound waves, but in light waves. We see the way that the light is changing as the galaxies move further away from us. So there's tons of evidence for the Big Bang being a reality, the best model we have for the origin of the universe. And it's been supported by many much more contemporary observations. There's one we're going through at the moment, which is to measure the cosmic, what's known as the cosmic background radiation of the universe. So after the Big Bang, there is this sort of afterglow, and we can see that. You know, we can see that with space telescopes. It, as always in science, what you do is you look at stuff, you make an observation, and then you try and work out the best fit model to explain that observation. And as it stands, there isn't anything that comes close to explaining the way we observe the universe than Big Bang.
How does it explain, Adam, how there's so much order in the universe? I mean, it seems like everything had a reason, that every piece of a puzzle seemed to fit to make a bigger picture. I mean, to me, that's astounding that I can't believe is random.
Well, it depends on how you measure order, right? So one of the things, I totally understand your point, but the thing is that we impose order because we're very, as humans, psychologically and evolutionarily, we're very predisposed to rationalizing things and putting them into well-understandable patterns, right? So we see pattern formation all the time. So when we look at the universe, we look for patterns, and the best pattern we can see is that there is a singular point from which all this expansion occurred. How you jump from that, seeing that pattern, to working out that there is, or suggesting that there is a reason for that, is not something that science does particularly well. Because, again, like I said a minute ago, the reason that we explain the way the universe observes is a lot to do with the maths and the dynamics of the basic fundamental laws of the universe, which seem to be non-negotiable, right? So right. Fundamental tenets of physics. So I think a lot of the issue that we have with that it looks like the universe is structured in a particular way is to do with the fact that we psychologically are very predisposed to seeing order where there maybe is less than we think. There is a, you know how some people talk about the Goldilocks zone, which is, I guess, relevant to my book, but the yep. Goldilocks zone being this area of space which is neither too hot nor too cold for life to exist, and that's where the Earth sits.
Mm-hmm. And they're finding planets that may have that same kind of feel.
Exactly. And that's fantastically exciting for science. I believe in the last week one was found which was a mere 5 light years away. So again, it's a similar sort of principle. We observe life in a particular zone, and then it's tempting to say, well, is life there because it's in that zone? Therefore, it looks like there's ontology here. It looks like there's design in there. Douglas Adams, the author of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, had a lovely comment on that, which is that when you see a puddle, isn't it amazing how it exactly fits the hole that it's sitting in?
So what came first, the hole or the puddle, right?
Right.
That's a good point. What, yeah. As you, as a scientist, look at what's happening in the universe and how things are unfolding, are you surprised with any of it?
That's a fabulous question. And actually, as a scientist, not one that I've really thought about. I'm constantly amazed by nature. And even though we've got a really solid grasp on how evolution works, and we have done for more than 150 years now, the astonishing adaptability of living organisms and the variance, the amazing variation that we see as a result of evolution, I think that is always surprising. And often you don't see the best of that in academic papers. Often you see the best of that on TV, with programs like in this country with David Attenborough, Life on Earth, and things like that, where they go out of their way to find the most extraordinary adaptations. Because, a lot of nature is just getting on with itself, and it's just trying to survive. But the way in which some species, some organisms do that is just, mesmerizing. It almost makes you think that someone was behind this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm still taking that stance, even though the whole thing continues to baffle me. Why do most scientists not believe in a godlike figure or an intelligent designer?
That's true. So some of the recent there's been a survey. We have survey data on scientists and their faith dating back to, I think, about 1920. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that is that it's been pretty much consistent. Right? So the percentage of active working scientists who believe in a god has remained pretty consistent throughout the 20th century. So that's one thing. You see a very much higher number of atheistic scientists in the higher echelons of the scientific establishment, so in the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S. and in the Royal Society here in the U.K. And it's about 9 out of 10 who are self-describe as atheists or people of no faith. But I think amongst working scientists, it's much lower than that. So it's I think it's more like about 60% describe themselves as atheists. And then within the different branches of science, you also see different variations. So on the whole, I think I'm right in saying, I don't have the data to hand, I think I'm right in saying that evolutionary biologists are the scientific group who have the lowest degree of faith, and physicists, particularly astrophysicists, have a higher. But it's not hugely different from the general populace, I think I'm right in saying that, but I could be wrong.
I would think it would be, but if you're right, that's pretty astounding.
Yeah, it is and it isn't. I mean, us humans are incredibly adept at holding two conflicting views at the same time. And I think a lot of the conversation over the last few years about religion and science has been massively skewed by the assumption that they are mutually exclusive on a practical life-living level. And my guess is that's not the case. I think that, you know, if you have a sort of academic discussion about the fact that I can't say, it's difficult to process the fact that I can say, well, this is evidence-based and this is not, and therefore I should believe one and not the other, right? That's the sort of discourse that happens in the press a lot. But, you know, most religious people don't spend a lot of time thinking about those things and are quite comfortable to just live out their lives using whatever cultural and familial relationship they have with whatever faith they're part of, in a way which doesn't necessarily, in my opinion, affect their ability to be a top-quality scientist if that is what they do. And so, you know, I come from a pretty strongly Catholic family.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
and
me too.
That doesn't provide any particular animosity or difficulty with the fact that I'm also a scientist. My granny, who goes to church twice a week, every time she sees me, she laughs at me and says, "Don't worry, I'll pray for you."
That's right. Cast the devil out of you, Adam.
Fine.
Has science changed over the years in its theories of life and its origin? Or has it been pretty much the same?
Yeah, it really has. Yeah, and what, the reason I wanted to write this book right now is because I think for the first time in a long time, we've got an origin of life idea, a model, that kind of works. Now, we're not there yet. All of these things are models because this is not history, this is science. So we can't go back and try and observe what happened the first time round. But what we can do is look at how life is now and then begin to think about how it could have come to be like that. And we've got, I think we're pretty sophisticated about doing this now, but it is still a model. We won't be able to say this is definitively how life began on Earth. But I do think that for the first time in history, and bearing in mind that we've been thinking about this question in a scientific sense for about 2,000 years, more than 2,000 years, Aristotle was the first person to start thinking about the scientific origin of life. I think for the first time in that period, we have something which is scientifically robust, a model which is scientifically robust.
Do you think that if there is life on other planets, I'm a big believer in that, believe me, that it's probably very similar to what we have here, and that the end of the intelligent chain, let's say it's a human being, will probably look somewhat like us?
Well, I mean, that's a fascinating question, and there's a number of stages to the answer, so I'll try and go through them as I think about it systematically. The first is, I think that the bearing in mind the number of planets that we're now finding, I think the likelihood of life in the rest of the universe existing is extremely high.
Let's hold it right there, Adam. We're going to hit the break, and we're going to come back right at that point. Adam Rutherford, our special guest, Creation: How Science is Reinventing Life Itself. We'll be back. Well, next hour, Science Buffs, we'll take your phone call with Adam Rutherford as we talk about creation. We'll be back in a moment and talk about life and similarities of life when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Adam Rutherford with us, his work, Creation. We'll get right into it. But Adam, we were talking about if life would look the same on other planetary systems. And you were talking about how so many Earth-like planets are being found now.
Yeah, that's right. And so I don't know what the number we're up to now. I think when I wrote the book, it was around about 1,000, but I think that number is just going up and up and up every every week. But also, that's going to be a tiny fraction based on the number of stars in the known universe, which is in the billions, right? If star systems are likely to have planets around them, which they seem to be, then the number of planets in the whole universe is going to be basically statistically inevitable that life will exist on at least one of them. Now, that's one thing, right? So I agree with you in the sense that I think it's highly likely that life in the universe exists. The second thing is this, that although we are the most sophisticated life form on Earth, I don't think we, in evolutionary terms, can class ourselves as the most successful, right? Given that there's been life continuously on this planet for 4 billion years. And for almost all of that time, it has been single-celled organisms such as bacteria and their cousins, archaea. And bacteria and archaea outnumber us by mass and by number and by longevity, by orders of magnitude, to the extent that me and you are made of about 100 trillion human cells, but we carry on us 10 times more bacterial cells, and that's how it should be. Most of them are either neutral or beneficial for us. So anyway, the point is that the dominant class of life on Earth is not us, nor even animals, nor plants, but bacteria and archaea. So I would suggest that the most likely form of life to exist on other planets in the rest of the universe would be much more similar to single-celled organisms like that dominate life on Earth and have done for the last 4 billion years. So that's the second thing. The third thing is I can't imagine a mechanism which is not based on the same principles of natural selection and evolution. Right? It's really difficult to conceive of a way in which life would emerge on a different planet that wasn't similar to the way it's emerged on this planet. But that's not to say we would look the same. If evolution on another planet had happened and we saw the same types of biochemistry and metabolism and genetics, if we want to call it that, on a different planet, if we saw that emerge, you only need to adjust one tiny thing in our own, for example, our own evolutionary history, and we don't look at anything like what we do now, right? So, you know, if we think about ourselves as being bipedal, 2 feet, evolved to come not swing in the trees, but to walk on the ground and all the things that make us human, all we have to do 1 million years ago or 3 million years ago or even 250,000 years ago is place that those events, human evolution, in a different physical context, and we probably wouldn't be bipedal. So I think if you run the tape again for evolution, or if you run it again on a different planet, I think it's highly unlikely that they'd come out looking like us.
But they'd be intelligent, no doubt.
Could be. Is intelligence an inevitability of evolution? It's very difficult to say. It is consciousness and intelligence in us is an emergent property of evolution. We see degrees of intelligence in many species, none like humans. It's almost impossible to answer that question because the sample size we have for intelligent life in the universe is one. And in terms of the length, the duration of life on Earth, our own intelligent period is the tiniest fragment. So we've been around in our current form for a maximum of 200,000 years. Right? We've been around in our modern context for around 10,000 years, so since we started farming. And life on Earth has existed for 4 billion years. So the chances of us overlapping in a 13-billion-year-old universe with another life form which displays similar levels of intelligence to us is pretty unlikely. So I think the first when we invent faster than light travel or travel that allows us to get to close to light speed so we can visit the next nearest habitable planet, I think we're likely to find. If there is life there, I think we're likely to find a sort of sludge of bacteria rather than, you know, the greys or aliens that can communicate with us. It's disappointing to find that out, but I think statistically that's more likely.
In Creation, your book, you talk about some genetic engineering and what is going to go on in the future. Let's take the rest of this hour, Adam, to get into that. Tell me some of the things that science is doing now.
Well, so what happened in the the reason this part of the story relates to what we've just been talking about, the origin of life on Earth, is that we have this singular system. You know, all life is based on exactly the same alphabet and metabolism. And what that says, when you combine everything we know about life as it exists on Earth right now, it points to a single origin, that all life on Earth evolved from a single organism, which we call LUCA, which stands for the last universal common ancestor. Now, one of the aspects of that universality of life on Earth is the genetic code, right? So every life form on Earth uses DNA as its genetic code. And DNA works in exactly the same way in every species, whether you are a human or a blue whale or a mushroom or a bacteria, right? It's identical coding,
right?
And it's identical letters. Now, what that means and what that meant in the 1970s and 80s when we discovered that is that you can just, we invented the technology to swap bits of genes between any organism, and it would still be read by the recipient, right? So it's like taking, you know, a universal language and being able to simply drop in something from a different country or written by someone else and putting it into your own dictionary, and we can just read it. And that's the basis of genetic engineering, right? So it was first done in 1973, and then since then there's been this enormous, huge sort of biotechnology revolution, which is the basis of almost all biomedical research now, almost all development of medicines now. In your country, in the United States, it forms a massively significant part of the food chain because genetically modified foods are...
There's an uproar out here, Adam, about that, let me tell you.
Sure, but it's nothing like the argument we had here, I'm sorry to say, because we've in the UK and Europe, they were outlawed in the 1980s, and we've never had any genetically modified food in our food chain since the 1980s.
We're still fighting over whether to label the food as such.
Yeah.
They can't even, decide that.
Yeah, and now I think the estimate has been, though, that in the United States in the last, I think it was when I wrote this, I think it was in 2012, and it was in the previous 3 years up until 2012, there had been something like 2 trillion meals consumed by humans in the United States that contained genetically modified food. Now, part of we get into arguments about the validity of GM often, but when you have a sample size like that, and you're questioning the safety of these products, if you've got 1 or 2 trillion people eating these foods on a regular basis, and you're not seeing any negative effects, then that says that they're safe, right? That satisfies all criteria for.
But we don't know if they are, though. See, that's the problem. You know, when you come down with cancers, stomach problems, and things, we don't know if it's related to the GMO food or not.
I think largely we do, though. I think on the whole, before they're allowed to get to market, they're tested rigorously. And by the time they get to market, they should have been tested rigorously enough that the possibility of the genetically modified parts of the food being causative in prompting diseases is vanishingly small. So... I honestly think it's reasonable to say that they're safe. It's also difficult as a biologist to imagine what the difficult mechanism would be, because the bits of genes that are used in for example, your maize, they are from different organisms, right? They're not created. They don't have any particular toxic effects in their organisms or when they're transferred into another one. So it is, in a sense, very much like the farming that we've been doing for 10,000 years, in that we're enhancing particular characteristics of whatever products we're looking at, but we're just doing it at a molecular level now. So there is no foodstuff that anyone eats could be possibly considered natural. They've all been designed by farming, unless you live in a remote island in the South Pacific.
Is it good, Adam, to play around with Mother Nature?
Is it good? It's a difficult question to answer because it's what we've always done. And there are very few in this country. There is no way you can go which I think you could qualify as being described as natural. Okay, 10,000 years worth of farming has meant that our entire landscape is the result of very careful design. So in terms of messing around with nature, yeah, that is what humans do. Almost by definition, we do that. That is not to say we should be gung-ho or irresponsible, and we should always work in concert with Mother Nature, with evolution, and not exploit it, but work alongside it. But it is fundamentally what we do.
Could it break down? Could something happen whenever they are genetically trying to modify animals, plants, something goes awry?
Conceivably, yes. And in the experiments that have been done, there are many, many controls are done, and they don't always work. So, I mean, what sort of animals are you talking about to trigger the conversation?
Well, you talk about the spider goat in your What the heck is that?
Yeah, it is. It's pretty freaky, and in fact, not that new technology. So, this relates to what I was just saying about farming and how we've become more effective and more efficient about farming. So, in 2001, a team based out of Utah, Logan in Utah, assembled the genes from a spider, a golden orb weaver spider. And they took the gene that the spider uses to make dragline silk. So spiders have a number of different types of silk, but dragline silk is the one that it swings from, right? So when it's swinging across a gap in order to make its web, it uses dragline silk. Okay, so this team based in Utah took that gene, and they inserted it into the genome of a goat so that it was right next door to the genes in the goat that trigger milk production when they lactate. Okay, something that goats do very well. Mm-hmm. So what that meant is that when they had that inside the goat embryo and the goat grew up to become an adult goat that lactated, when the goat lactates and produces milk, the goat is called Freckles. I'm going to stop calling her a goat. The goat is called Freckles. When Freckles lactates, her milk is full of spider silk. Now, Freckles doesn't make any difference to her. Yeah. So you milk the goat. And you take, and I've done this. This is the only goat I've ever milked in my life. You get a liter of goat's milk out of Freckles, and you process it to remove the fat, which takes about a couple of hours. And then once you've got it into this more pure state, you can simply take a glass rod and you stick it into the milk, and you can lift out the spider silk, and then you hook it onto a little spool, and the spool rotates very slowly, and it rotates, and it makes a continuous thread.
Where the heck did they get the spider silk? I mean, how did that happen?
The goat makes it. So the goat makes it based on the gene that they've taken from the original spider. They take the gene from the spider, they put it in the goat. The goat is. It's astonishing. It's breathtaking. The goat makes it because, like I was saying a minute ago, the language of DNA is universal. So the goat doesn't know it's a spider gene. All it sees is DNA. You put it in the right way, which is quite a tricky business to do. You need to be pretty skilled to do that. The goat doesn't see it as any different from its own genes, and so it just enacts this program, which means that its milk has spider silk in it. Now, the question that everyone wants to know is, well, why the heck would you want to do that? And the answer is that spider silk is one of the most interesting materials known to humankind, right? It has a higher elastic strength and a higher tensile strength than anything that we've made. If you could scale up a piece of spider silk to the dimension of a steel cable, it would be dozens of times more elastic and dozens of times stronger.
If I see some goat up there in a spider web, I'm out of there. I'm gone.
But normally when I mention this in talks and lectures, people start singing the song that Homer Simpson sings when he sings Spider Pig in the Simpsons movie.
But I would guess,
not quite the same thing.
I would guess a goat would produce more silk than a spider.
It does. It does. The reason we do this, so the material is really interesting in itself, and we want to be able to take that material and use it for things like, such as, it's stronger than Kevlar, so people are talking about using it for bulletproof vests or for tires.
Amazing.
It's also, it doesn't generate an immune response in the same way that many things that we use in our body to replace, for example, ligament or tissue damage. So, and the Greeks knew this. The Greeks would take spider webs on the battlefield with them, and when they got a wound, they'd take a spider web and try and patch up the wound with spider silk. So, you know, in a sense, it's very ancient knowledge, this. It's just we're much more efficient at producing it. So, that's why we do it. The reason you stick it in a goat is because goats are easy to farm, and spiders are impossible to farm. So if you put spiders on the whole tend to be cannibalistic. If you put two female spiders of almost any species next to each other, then within a few minutes you're going to have one. And what we do with farming, what we've always done with farming, is identify something that we want, something desirable that exists in nature, and breed it over generations so that that characteristic becomes enhanced so that we can extract it. And for the most part, that's food, right? So if you want an apple that it has a lovely red, shiny skin, flesh, then over thousands of years, farmers have bred different types of apples until you get that perfect one that we want and that we can sell and that we can eat. And the same with, you know, rice, which feeds billions of people on Earth. That is not a naturally occurring product. That is a combination at some point, probably around 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, of either accidentally or a farmer crossing a type of grass with a type of wheat. So it's not natural in any way. It's been designed like that. Bananas is great example.
Does the goat show any signs of being a spider besides the production of the silk?
For all intents and purposes, Freckles is a very normal, happy goat. And as they live full goat-like length lives in a very nice farm in Logan in Utah, and they are absolutely unaware of the fact that they are one of the strangest creatures that has ever existed.
So no multiple legs or anything like that?
No, they look like a goat. I went on this farm, and they behave like goats. I was the first time I met Freckles, I was making a TV program for the BBC. And I was talking to the farmer, well, not a scientist. He's not a farmer. He's a scientist, a guy called Randy Lewis at Utah University. And the damn thing kept chewing on my trousers. So, you know, I was trying to be all serious and talk about the science and the incredible nature of this animal. And, it really took a big hole out of my trousers while I was just talking. So, you know, Freckles is a normal goat, but an extraordinary normal goat.
Could anything go wrong? Think about that. We're going to take this break and come back. We'll take phone calls with Adam Rutherford and also check in to see if anything could go wrong with this manipulation. I'll be back.